Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Gay Talese, whose latest book is A Writer's Life. Earlier books include The Kingdom and the Power, Honor Thy Father, Thy Neighbor's Wife, Unto the Sons, The Gay Talese Reader. Gay Talese is considered one of the founders of what they call New Journalism.
I'm not sure, but I've been hung to a degree with that description, and much as I would like to disassociate myself with it, I don't seem to be able to. And the reason I cannot get away from it is because Tom Wolfe, who's a friend of mine and who was being very kind to me in print way back in 1972 or 3 or 4, whenever he wrote the book called The New Journalism, he gave me credit for being a founder. And I didn't think I was a founder of anything, and I didn't think I was a new journalist, whatever that meant, because what I was doing then and what I do now is essentially the same thing. I'm a storyteller, but I do not use fiction as my way of telling a story. I do it nonfiction. I'm a factual person. I'm an old-fashioned, not a new-fashioned, old-fashioned reporter. I do a lot of legwork, and then I take a lot of time and I organize, and that's it. The new journalism is something that I don't necessarily embrace, because what happened, while I have enormous respect for Tom Wolfe as a writer, as a researching writer, incidentally, all of his novels are very well researched. If you read A Man in Full, and he is a man also who discovers things, and he discovered new journalism.
I always got the feeling that, you know, the idea of the so-called nonfiction novel, which, you know, the movie Capote tells us started with Capote, insofar as I know it started with Picture with Lillian Ross anyway.
I would endorse what you said. Lillian Ross was an early writer of The New Yorker and that making of a film, The Red Badge of Courage. But I go back to Orwell, and, you know, there were guys in the 1930s that were doing this. I mean, one of my favorite books, which I cite in my own book, is Down and Out in Paris and London. That's a great book about working in a kitchen of a restaurant. And that's pretty what inspired me to want to hang around restaurants and write about those characters, some of which I did in this book. You know, people come up with this title of something, and it catches on. And new journalism caught on with college professors back in the 70s after Wolfe's book was released. A lot of men and women who teach writing, nonfiction writing, fiction writing, journalism, magazine writing, whatever, love this new journalism thing. But what happened to make me want to kind of run away from it, try to run away, was a lot of people who followed Wolfe and myself and Norman Mailer, Capote, they all did great nonfiction works. Mailer wins the Pulitzer Prize with his March on the Pentagon stuff for Willie Morris's Harper's Magazine. And, of course, the great Capote's book, In Cold Blood, was supposed to be a nonfiction novel. You know, everybody has a little gimmick going when they advertise themselves. Advertising Myself was the very title of one of Mailer's books. But I just feel that there has to be a distinction between fiction and nonfiction. And some of those new journalists that came along in the 70s and 80s were all interested in promoting themselves and having full expression of what it was that they felt themselves, and did not have any legwork, did not do the research. And there's so much inaccuracy in the whole term.
This is being taped not at KPFA, but actually in your office in New York. And I'm looking around and seeing the research material for this book and your previous books, the huge amount of research material. And on the way here, I was reading an early article of yours, which I happen to have here, about Frank Sinatra. You go into detail about what people are wearing. When I read something today and it says so-and-so was wearing, I don't know whether the author's making it up or not.
Well, nor do I. Where we are speaking, incidentally, underground, we're in my house in New York, but we're under it, and we're in what I call the bunker. And where we are now is a place without a telephone. It's a place without a bell, doorbell, and where I work. And we're surrounded by research material, and we're surrounded by desks, and we're surrounded by styrofoam walls, which I pinprick into it notes that I keep when I'm working. It's my escape hatch.
Gay Talese, let's talk a little about your book, A Writer's Life. This book consists of pretty much failed material. I'm not sure if failed is the right word.
A bunch of stories that I think demonstrate what you can do in nonfiction reliably.
But were they all supposed to be books?
No. No, none of them are supposed to be books.
Really?
I could have done them singularly as little books. And there are some times that big-time writers can do little books, and that's good. I wanted to write about writing, and I wanted to write about what it is that I do, which is to tell stories. And I had a lot of stories I wanted to tell, but I wanted to tell them in one book. And I wanted to weave these stories in and out of my narrative. If you do a marker on this book, and you start at page one, and you work your way through 455 pages, and you took arrows, you take directional arrows, you'll find this book goes in and out and all over the place, and it wings, but it has a center. and it's balanced. And what I do is I begin the book and I end the book with reference to a Chinese woman that I saw on television one day when she was playing soccer with her team in the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. And I became interested in that woman because I just became mesmerized watching her on television. What it is the fantasies of a writer seeing someone on television, saying, I really want to make a connection with her, and flying to China later on and making a connection with her and with her family and with all the things that fiction writers can make up, but nonfiction writers can do it by doing it by being there.
Maybe I had this wrong. My assumption was that each of these was research and writing, and you couldn't quite find the core of a book in them, and then you realized that you could put it together and create a book about writing. But it sounds like you're saying that each of these segments was written for the book.
It'd be nice if I was able to market this book better than was done. I don't mean to look for excuses. It is not a book about failure. It is a book that has a theme of perseverance. When I was a young man, my first job when I was 24, I'm 74 now, so that's a half a century ago. My first job was a sports writer. It was with the New York Times, and I was 24. And I used to go to sporting events. And the people that interest me as a sports writer, interest me most, were not necessarily the people that won the game, but the people that lost the game. Because in the locker room after the game was over, you would hear their reasoning. And sometimes, because they lost a fight or got beaten up by the pitcher in a baseball game or struck out with the bases, whatever it is, they lose their jobs. I mean, it's not just losing a game. They become very expendable. And I was thinking, what a wicked way of making a living. You're out there in front of three or four, hundreds of thousands of fans, and you're in a public place, and you lose not only the game, or you lose the team, loses the game, but you lose your job, and then you are 25, 26, 27, and then what do you do? I mean, what are you prepared for? You're an athlete, and you're not even 30 years old, and then you have to worry about learning to be a bartender, work in a store or something like that. I became interested in the stories that were not necessarily the headline-making or the celebratory stories, but rather the more everyday kind of stories, which people who have their ups and downs, take their knocks, get off the floor. This is what kind of story I used to do when I was a working sports writer. And as I got older and older, and I used to do longer pieces for magazine, like Frank Sinatra, that's this kind of story. Frank Sinatra was a guy who was pretty much on his rear end. He was a superstar at the age of 23 or 4 in the 1940s. And then he reached in the mid-50s, a time when he couldn't even get a job. And he was a real loser for a while. His wife left him, and people didn't want him around, and he had to beg for a little part and from here to eternity. And that really is his comeback story. I love that story. That's what I wrote in called Frank Sinatra Has a Cold. But I never talked to Frank Sinatra. And in this book, which is A Writer's Life, I don't really have to talk to people. I'm writing about atmospherically about different people. The soccer woman from China that I mentioned. I mentioned Orwell before. I have a character in a waiter. I write about a waiter in a restaurant. In a restaurant that's not Le Cirque. It's not a 4-star, 5-star restaurant. It is an ordinary, very ordinary place. But there's an extraordinary story in an ordinary place. And that was this waiter, the life of a waiter. I read about John Bobbitt, guy that had bad experiences. This guy loses his penis in a domestic quarrel with his wife. He gets drunk one night, falls asleep, and he wakes up and he's got a chopped off penis. And I thought that was an extraordinary story, though. The headlines wiped it out, made a big trivial thing out of it, a big joke. Jay Leno and all those people were joking for months and months. But I stayed with that story. 10 years later, I wanted to know. I saw it as a real story of a man who goes into the Marine Corps and then loses his position in the Marine Corps. And it's like a story that you think, well, who cares about this? But if you do deal with the research, as I do, you get a kind of tragic figure out of a Russian novel. And there are stories like the old newspaper guys I used to work for. There's a lot in here that I hate to call it a memoir, which is what it's been called. And I've been condemned, maybe rightly, if you can believe the people. Why didn't he write a memoir? I didn't want to write a memoir. I wanted to do something quite different with nonfiction to show you can write as a nonfiction writer if you do enough work, meaning research, and you create your style in a way that's storytelling. You can tell stories about just about anything. And this was to demonstrate that. To my satisfaction, if not to the satisfaction of everybody who's read it.
Gatelise, there's a quote that you made. A scene happens, but you have to have the perception of it as a scene. And that's, I guess, as true for nonfiction as fiction. If you kind of have to find your angle, how you're going to view it, what story you're going to tell within context.
There are writers and there are readers who love fiction. Fiction is their mode. And there are people like me who love fiction, who only read fiction, but do not want to write fiction. If you do enough work, if you spend enough time, maybe years, with your character, getting to know your people, you can use real names and really describe authentically what happens to these people that you are with. You can present to your reader a story that they may think is made up, but it's not made up. And that is what gives me the thrill or gives me the satisfaction. See, nonfiction is usually about famous people. Nonfiction is where you get a Robert Carroll writing about Lyndon Johnson. Or nonfiction is where you get someone writing about the true life of Orson Welles. And, you know, or nonfiction is where the reader, more often than not, knows the subject that you're writing about. It's a historical book or a biographical book or maybe a movie star that you know about or maybe a notorious mass killer, whoever it is. It's generally someone who's been in the headlines. What I wanted to do is not that. I want to do the opposite. I want to write someone who's necessarily not well known or is perhaps known in a way and long forgotten, and then I resurrect them. It's just where I want to dwell. That's all it amounts to, Richard. It's just where I want to stake my claim to territory that I don't think has been overexplored or exploited. Philip Roth, one of my favorite fiction writers, while I greatly admire fiction writers, especially at the highest level, which is where Roth dwells, I wanted to write history that the historians will ignore, that the characters are not historically worthy, are not even newsworthy. When I wrote about Sinatra, it was a character. When I wrote the history of the New York Times, it was about people didn't write about the insignificant people, but they are insignificant, most of them, who worked for the Times at the period I wrote. The gangsters, I wrote about mobsters. I didn't write about the godfathers. I wrote about the wives, the bodyguards, the supernumeraries in that book called Honor the Father.
When you see something like The Sopranos, do you realize that they had to have read your book?
I would think they had, because when I wrote that book, it was way back in 1972. I lived in San Jose. I lived in Northern California a lot of the time because Joe Bonanno, the boss of the Bonanno family, had lost the war in Brooklyn. There was an interrival faction feuding, and the Bonannos were driven out, and the father went to settle in Tucson, and the son, Bill Bonanno, is the lieutenant in that family, in the mafia family, went to live in San Jose, and I went to live in San Jose for a while back in 72, 73, to hang out with him and some of the gangs that were still there. More in exile. They were like an exiled mafia family in Northern California. That's where I wrote that book.
Gay Talese, let me ask you then, when you're getting that involved in a book, when you're getting that involved in the events that happened in a restaurant, 206 East 63rd Street, when you're seriously opening massage parlors for thy neighbor's wife, how do you separate yourself out so that it isn't autobiography, that it isn't Gay Talese's story, and yet at the same time, aren't you influencing events too?
What I do is try to form a kind of relationship, a partnership, an alliance with people I find not only interesting to me, but I can identify with. Every person I've ever written about, I've identified with. You mentioned gangsters. And you say, okay, I identified with the son of Joseph Bonanno because I'm an Italian-American. I am about a year older than Bill Bonanno, the son. Our fathers, the gangster Joseph Bonanno and my father, Joseph Talese, a tailor, came from a part of Italy that's separated only by a few miles. These men were born around the same time. They came to America in the same time, 1920, 21. The life of the gangster Bill Bonanno, the son of Joe Bonanno, and my life are just very close in terms of our history, our geographical history, our ancestral history. And what I wanted to do is ask myself, how come I am who I am, and how come Bill Bonanno, my contemporary, is who he is? And where are we linked emotionally? What is it that makes him go to jail, because he went a lot of times to jail, and I never went to jail, and I'm a law-abiding citizen, and he is an intelligent, he went to college, as I did, he went to the University of Arizona, I went to the University of Alabama, you know, it's a lot of stuff. And I identify with him throughout that book. His, the woman he married, the children he had, I got to know them all very, very well. Let's say the story about thy neighbor's wife. Okay, thy neighbor's wife, so who do you identify with there? A lot of people. The book Thy Neighbor's Wife takes place, most of it, in California, in Southern California, and parts of it in Chicago. The boy who opens the first chapter of that book is a boy of 17 named Harold Rubin, who had fantasies of a beautiful woman who poses nude on the beaches of Southern California, near the Mexican border, some places south of San Diego. Her name is Diane Weber. When I was a boy in my little town of Ocean City, New Jersey, I knew a guy who worked behind the counter of a cigar store, a newspaper place where they sold magazines. Under the counter, and this is the 1940s and 50s, there was a magazine called Sunshine and Health. There was a nudist magazine. And the star of that magazine, the most beautiful woman in the history of nudity, at least at that time after World War II, was this woman, Diane Weber. When I first met this guy in Chicago, I was doing research in massage parlors. You mentioned before, I operated massage parlors myself when I was doing research. I had two massage parlors in New York, and I was visiting massage parlors in California and also Chicago. When I went to Chicago, I met Harold Rubin, and I said, "What is it got you in this business?" He said, "Diane Weber. You mean the famous beautiful woman that used to pose on the beaches of the Baja and in the Sunshine and Health magazines?" That's exactly who it was. I said, "I used to look at her pictures too." Again, it's like the identity, like with Bill Bonanno. I said, "Where is she now? Where is she now?" I said, "I think she lives out," Rubin said, "I think she lives somewhere in Southern California outside of L.A. Well, I wanted to meet her, and I went out there and I met her and I wrote about her. And I was thinking about Harold Rubin and Diane Weber. And then Hugh Hefner was the first magazine publisher. Playboy, you know, started in 1953. And I had an Irish Catholic background. I'm Italian, but I came out of a strict Irish Catholic parish. And we had people saying that this is dirty, this is dirty, this is dirty, this is sinful. Don't listen to this. And I grew up with this sense of censorship strongly imbued in me. And so when I'm writing about Diane Weber's wife and talking to Harold Rubin in Chicago and meeting Diane Weber later and Hugh Hefner, who also lived in Los Angeles, still does, I'm really writing about my era, meaning the period that came after World War II, and we had a sense of sin and a sense of obscenity that didn't exist in the 1970s or 80s. I mean, I remember when I first went to San Francisco in the mid-1960s, and I remember there were topless and bottomless bars out there in North Beach. I mean, I was seeing something for the first time. Now nobody would even pay attention to this stuff, but you have to be a historian of sorts of my age, someone who was born in the 1930s, who came of age in the late 1940s after World War II, know something about the GI mentality after the World War II years, growing up in the 1950s when the president was Dwight Eisenhower, the general himself. And then you go to the 60s and the change in America, the change in films, the films you could see that you couldn't see in the 1940s. In 1960s, you could read books you couldn't read in the 1940s because they were considered obscene. You could go to the theater in New York. You go to the theater in the 1970s and see Old Calcutta and nudity on the stage. Whereas when I was a boy, Sunshine and Park was a racy little thing you sold under the counter. I wanted to write a history of America's redefinition of morality. That book, Thy Neighbor's Wife, I am really, really seeing it from my vantage point while I'm writing about Harold Rubin, while I'm writing about Mr. Hugh Hefner, while I'm writing about Diane Weber and who else. That's really me in that.
You're listening to an interview with Gay Talese, whose latest book is A Writer's Life. Gay Talese, what you're saying is that even though you are pulling out Gay Talese and the word I may not appear all that much, it's there so strongly.
Absolutely.
That in essence, you're telling your story. That's in true. Each of these books.
That's right. Absolutely right. And Thy Neighbor's Wife, I'm doing so more clearly because I'm writing about the writer. And the writer is not having triumph after triumph. The writer is struggling. I don't care if you're writing about the aforementioned Philip Roth or Ernest Hemingway or great writers. I mean, Hemingway killed himself and he won the Nobel Prize. You say, well, why would a guy who won the Nobel Prize be so unhappy? How much, you can't win a greater award than that. But there is times you just, the setback for the writer is like the setback for the athlete. I mean, Michael Jordan had his bad nights. I mean, I'm talking to you now when we're dealing with baseball, and look at Barry Bonds. Now, here's a guy that is like the Stations of the Cross. When I was a Catholic altar boy, you see the Christ figure that gets beaten up in the first station and then whipped and falls behind the cross. I know you got the steroid thing and everybody has their own view. I am not yet willing to convict on that steroid issue. Mr. Bonds, a while past Babe Ruth, okay, but they are people that like to crucify this guy. If I were writing today, if I had an assignment from Sports Illustrated or San Francisco Chronicle, whatever, right, I would go around the league with him, and I'd be writing about the savages in the stands of Philadelphia of St. Louis, wherever they are. I'd follow the Giants around. These people in these stands throwing stuff out at him, steroids, needles or beer bottles or whatever it is. I'd be writing about how permissive the owners of baseball clubs are toward the fans who buy the tickets. And they go out there and they just vilify the athlete. Okay, the athlete makes a lot of money, and they always say, oh, he makes millions. And, you know, whether you're talking about some basketball star or baseball star or football star, makes no difference. They're really the gladiators. They're being devoured by the lions. The lions often are the people in the stands who abuse these people day after day after day. These athletes are totally, you know, the sports writers don't even tell you about this. The sports writers who cover these teams rarely give the reader the sense of what it is like to be on the field as a professional athlete. And that's the kind of work I do. I give you, I think, I hope I'm telling you the truth, because I think I am, a picture that the reader wouldn't get if I wasn't doing the chronicling. Sounds vain, but that's what I do.
Why do you think so many sports writers, I mean, let's take the Bonds incident. This is a book that Gay Talese has not written and won't write.
That's right.
But how come these sports writers are crucifying him? I mean, are they just another generation of moralists, a network of Bill Bennett's?
They're hypocrites. They're hypocrites. The sports writers are either in the pocket of management, or they are there to humiliate these high-priced risk-takers who are the athletes. I don't believe there's such a thing as a high-priced athlete. I don't care if they're making $16 million a year. The reason I say that is in order to be up to that level, to be a superstar, I don't care what the sport, tennis or basketball or whatever, you have to be able to beat out so many people from the time you were 3 and 4 and 5 years of age, up through high school, then college, then professional sports. And then you have to be able to survive injury. If you loaf it, if you don't go in all out to make the catch, and you get a broken ankle or some kind of hip injury or a bad back, I mean, you can have a 2-year career. Most of these athletes do not have a 10-year career. Most of them have a 2-year career. And once they are out of the picture, whatever the sport, they are really into an obscure way of life where there are very few people who give much of a damn about them. I think to be an athlete, to make a lot of money, and also to be subjected to be traded, and if you have kids and you have a wife, is not an entirely enviable position. I know there are great lives to be led by the great athletes who are also lucky, but it is a tough way to make a living.
Gay Talese, you also talk about Selma, Alabama. It injects a political element into your book or writer's life. Now, you talk about having been in Alabama when you were in college and then in the 60s. What's Selma like today?
Well, Selma, in that book, this could have been a separate book. Alabama, to me, is a place where I first got an education. I finished high school at 17, and I went to Alabama to college. My father was a tailor, I mentioned before, and one of the persons he made suits for, he was a doctor who was born in Alabama. And when it came time for me to go to college, I didn't get into any college, to tell you the truth, because my grades weren't so great. But this doctor said, oh, we'll send him to Alabama, I told my father, and that's just what happened. So in 1949, when I was 17 in the fall, I went by train down there to Alabama, and I started 4 years of college. Of course, there was segregation, as most of your audience knows. And then I went to New York, and later on I got a job as a newspaper reporter. And then in 1964-65, which is about 11 years after I graduated from Alabama, which was in 1953, I returned as a reporter for the Times to cover some of the civil rights stories. You know, myself and a lot of reporters were covering this big march that left Selma, which is an old plantation town. Martin Luther King's people and Andy Young and all the civil rights prominent people of the 1960s were involved. I reported it. Bloody Sunday was a big incident that led to the Voting Rights Bill. It's a very famous, notorious time in American history. And I wrote my stories, and then I left the newspaper business, but I kept going back to Selma. 1970s and 1980s and 19. I just want to see, after the march is over, after the people stop singing We Shall Overcome, and most people forgot about civil rights. I mean, that's a dead issue right now. It is and it isn't. There is segregation in this country still. I'm talking in 2006. It's not segregation in the workplace so much. You find, whether it's in a shopping mall or whether it's in a corporate business, a law firm or Wall Street or where, there are blacks and whites working together. At night, once the stores close and the offices close, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, then you find the separation of the races. Even in restaurants. I mean, I live in New York. You go out to New York restaurants in 2006. You're not going to find many black people with white people having dinner. You'll find more of them in Alabama. I know if I went down to Selma to the old Tally Ho restaurant, which is one of the restaurants I know in that town, you'll find blacks and whites being much more congenial and closely associated and even geographically associated than you will in New York, Philadelphia, Boston. I don't even think San Francisco qualifies very high here. I went to a great restaurant, and I didn't see any black people there. Now, I don't want to condemn any restaurant, but this is the way it is in America. Let's not kid one another. We're not kidding one another. So I'm writing about Selma in this book, and I really do say that. I have characters in this section on Alabama, and there's a black man that marries a white woman. There's also a black man who rapes a white woman on the campus of the University of Alabama. And the march that Dr. King led back in the 1960s is the same road that led past this old plantation property that in 2006 is owned by a man who is the father of the white woman who was raped on the University of Alabama campus by a black man, and it was never even dealt with as a story. I show you the irony and the hypocrisy and also the dissatisfaction that follows in the wake of the Civil Rights Bill of the 50s and 60s. It's really a country of segregation still to this day.
Since you finished the book, have you been back?
Yeah, a week ago. It's the same. The country and the city, if you could take little areas, little towns, and they serve as a indication of the larger nation. I went down to Birmingham a week ago. The blacks and whites are kind of more comfortable with one another in the Deep South than they are in my hometown, such as it is, New York, today. Of course, you say that goes back to the old days of the Civil War period. You know, the blacks and whites are slaves, but they're living in the same house. And you say, okay, are you talking about this patriarchal system? Are you talking about the relation between the slave and the landowner? Yes, it was close. Well, I'm not talking about that because that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about, did the dream of the 1960s when Martin Luther King had a dream? Everybody had a dream back then. Now it is almost a half a century later. Where are we?
Gay Talese, you've been a journalist and you wrote about the New York Times. What the hell has been happening with journalism? Why do you think they fell asleep for George W. Bush?
After what happened on September 11, 2001, there became a kind of jingoism that spread into this country, a war-mongering mentality, a mentality that wanted to punish someone, and that mentality that created this fervor about patriotism and, of course, concern and worry. I mean, legitimate concern about being the subject of more terrorism because we didn't know who the enemy was, etc., etc. What this did to the American journalistic establishment, particularly covering the presidency, covering the Pentagon, covering our government, federal government, was to have patriotism defined by the government of George Bush, so that if you would dare present something that seemed a little bit unpatriotic, however you might define that, in these sensitive times it was very hard to define that, you could have your character ruined. You could have your advertisers withdraw. So the papers became timid. The newspaper reporters became timid with regard to government, people in power, the Rumsfelds, the George Bushes, and the whoever, State Department, Defense Department. Do you know the comedian named Bill Maher? He said something once on his show that, you know, you can say what you want about those terrorists, but boy, you can't say that they're not courageous. And boy, he was practically driven off the air. I mean, that seems like a statement that you might swell. It's a free country. We have freedom of speech. Don't we have freedom of speech? Can't you say what you want? I mean, Lenny Bruce went to jail way back for saying, you know, in 1950s, for saying words that were not supposed to be said. But we're supposed to be long beyond Lenny Bruce. We're supposed to have defined First Amendment freedom in ways that was not permissible a decade, two or three decades ago. That's not true. I mean, whatever happened to Bill Maher could happen to anybody. When reporters, with the permission of and the encouragement of their publishers, became embedded with troops in Iraq, meaning you rode in an armored personnel carrier, a Humvee, or a tank, and you were traveling with some unit, you became very much part of the PR department of the Pentagon. Sometimes, of course, reporters were in the wrong place at the wrong time. But that aside, meaning we do have those tragedies, but look at the tragedies that befall American soldiers, and not to say nothing of people who are civilians. All of this cannot be too criticized by the newspapers because, you know, you still see these vehicles, support our troops on the highway, and this whole definition of patriotism is being defined by the Republican administration of President Bush, and we are, all of us, to a smaller degree or a larger degree, intimidated. And the press has been very, very, very negligent in covering the government in a tough way, I think.
What do you think the role of the Republican noise machine has on journalists?
Those who support the administration and support the war And there are a lot of people that still do. I mean, we have people in political life, the Democrats. Hillary Clinton supports the war. I mean, no one, again, that's what I said before. There are people that are afraid to come out against the war. This government in power has so defined patriotism that it made us all captive to their definition of what is patriotic. To go against the word of the government is to almost run yourself into the corner of being contrarian or a dissident or a unpatriotic American.
How can we break that?
Well, we haven't been able to break it because the war goes on. The war in Iraq goes on and on. And it's in a situation where if you're a senator or a member of the House, if you say, let's get out of there, some have already done that. Let's get out of there. Others say, well, you can't abandon this issue. Our credibility in the world will go down. We will be tolerating terrorism. But how they've managed in Washington to make Saddam Hussein the real guy that destroyed the World Trade Center. I mean, to a lot of Americans, you would think after 4 years, they still think that the dictator of Iraq was the guy who set the terrorists off to destroy parts of Washington and parts of New York in that famous 2001 9/11 incident. And it shows you how much distortion can take hold and become almost total belief in accuracy of what happened.
But you're a journalist. You're still writing. Do you see for yourself, I mean, have you worked on anything where any of this has come up?
I'm not a political writer. I never was. I never wanted to be, because the reason I never wanted to be is I wanted to be able to write about subjects that were not going to be outdated tomorrow. Even when I was a daily newspaper guy, when I first started off 40 years ago, I never wanted to write stuff that was news. I wanted to write the feature stories, the little vignettes, the character sketches, the off-lead, you know what I'm talking about. Because that stuff, if it was written well, could be like a little short story, like a little fiction, like a vignette, a scene. Well, I wanted to be a scene setter and a dialogue writer, a storyteller, and I didn't want to be a news chronicler, a foreign correspondent. I just didn't want to do that. I wanted to carve out my territory, and my territory is on the side streets of life, that I think if you illuminate it properly and if you write well, you can have stories that people could read this year, next year, 10 years from now, 5 years ago. It becomes timeless if it's done well. And great fiction is timeless. Great stories are timeless.
Do you think this a sequel to The Kingdom and the Power of what has gone on in the New York Times in the past 40 years?
To a degree, I could do something about the New York Times, but when I wrote The Kingdom and the Power, I was really writing with a very intimate knowledge of the paper. If I would go back now and would have to rely on what people told me, I would be, in a way, like those poor people that have to cover George Bush. They would put their spin on everything. Let's just like Bush's, but the Bush people are tremendously effective spin artists. I mean, they're better than the press. The reason we can't get a very insightful view of what went wrong and this weapons of mass destruction and all the other signs of neglect by the press toward the people in power. Because the people who are in the press cannot get inside. They don't really know. And those who are on the inside have such skill in interpreting as they wish to be interpreted and making that the defining definition of what happened and what is happening. I mean, Condoleezza Rice, she is one of the great, great sopranos of spin there is around. If you watch television on Sunday, all these talk shows, you see them trotted out every Sunday. There'd be Rumsfeld, but Condoleezza, she can be mouthing this and that, and she does it so smoothly. She's got it so programmed. She is so on message, as we're afraid, that you never can get her off. They parrot a kind of truth, and they are not able to be knocked off by any trenchant journalist or talk show host. Those people in Washington know how to tell their story.
It seems to me that the story of the past 20 years in America is really the story of media, and it's a story of journalism or non-journalism.
It's a story of controlling, to a great degree, the way people think, because the people have access to such limited amounts of information that is garnered and doctored and garnished by those who are setting the table, who are cooking the meals, who are feeding us. Well, they're feeding us. We are sitting out there and being fed, sometimes spoon-fed, by people who are master chefs in this world of making it up or putting a kind of shape to it, that we don't have much option beyond what we're given. And what we're given has already been manhandled by those who are manipulators. We are being ruled by a manipulating government that is good. I mean, I'm telling you, they are good. They are really good in controlling the message. We are right now in the early part of the 21st century. I think our ill-informed and overly informed at the same time. We have so much news around the clock, all this stuff comes out. And of course, if it's an auto accident or some sinking ship, all right, then it's really reporting and it's news. But when it comes to what is from the forefront of our battles in Iraq or Afghanistan, we don't have any access to what's going on. We are told by the public information officer, by the spokesperson for the Defense Department, or by the Defense Secretary himself, or by the Secretary of State herself, we're told. We're getting a lot of press that is not very reliable, and we don't have any dissenting. There's nobody dissenting. In the 60s, when we had the war, we had conscription. We had people, educated people, who were getting drafted, and they didn't like it, and they had a voice, and their parents were powerful people, and we had dissent. The tragedy here is the people that are in the armed services are not people who are drafted, but they volunteered. And this volunteer army is very, very bad for our country, I think. Because generally speaking, except for those who are the parents of service people, the nation is not so involved in the war. It's not really inconvenienced greatly by the war. If you don't have a child over there, then you really are, with all the support of our troops on the back of some damn vehicle, that's a cheap little price to pay for this. But I wish we had the draft. If we had the draft, this war would be over in a month. There wouldn't be any war if we had the draft, because the members of Congress, the CEOs, the people who are running our business as well as our nation, the lobbyists, the influence peddlers, the newspaper publishers, boy, if they had their children in this war, there would be a very, very different headline, I'll tell you, every day, and very little would be believed out of the government, because we'd have people in the streets, as we used to have in the old early 1970s and 60s, when we had active dissent against the government's policies. That's what I think.
Gates Lease, what are you working on right now? You're working on anything?
Yeah, I am, but I don't want to talk about it. I'm going to come back on your show when I'm finished.
You've been listening to an interview with Gates Lease, whose book is A Writer's Life. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.